Hello and welcome to the podcast for the summer 2013 issue of the journal Pediatric Physical Therapy. I'm Donovan Stutel. This month, postural balance in children with juvenile idiopathic arthritis, validation of the TIMSI for children with spinal muscular atrophy type 1, use of the GMFM in infants younger than 2 years, and more. This podcast is brought to you by the Section on Pediatrics of the American Physical Therapy Association. The section seeks to promote the highest quality of life for all children, people with developmental disabilities, and their families. First, here is Editor-in-Chief Anne Van Sant with her editorial, Optimizing Movement.
Since the year 2000, the American Physical Therapy Association has been guided by Vision 2020, a statement adopted by the APTA House of Delegates that guides the organization's strategic planning. That vision states, by 2020, physical therapy will be provided by physical therapists who are doctors of physical therapy, recognized by consumers and other healthcare professionals as the practitioners of choice to whom consumers have direct access for the diagnosis of, interventions for, and prevention of impairments, activity limitations, participation restrictions, and environmental barriers related to movement, function, and health. Vision 2020 is still guiding the efforts of the APTA and will do the same for the next several years. But in 2011, the House passed a motion that started the process to envision a future beyond 2020. To that end, the task force that has guided this process will be proposing a new vision for the profession in June that will be considered by the House. That vision statement is as follows. The physical therapy profession will transform society by optimizing movement for all people of all ages to improve the human experience. This Beyond 2020 vision statement brings a new perspective to our organization that I personally find refreshing and vital to our continued relevance. I see the statement as one that reinforces our professional commitment to society and thus emphasizes an outward focus, rather than one that could be perceived as primarily focused on physical therapists' professional development. I encourage members to visit the Beyond Vision 2020 website by doing a web search on APTA Beyond Vision 2020. There you can access the ongoing discussions and comments of members, consumers, and other healthcare professionals, as well as information on the elements of the vision statement that will be considered for adoption by the House in June. Your thoughts and comments are important to the ongoing consideration of this proposal, and I encourage you to explore the background documents available on the website and to voice your opinion to your state delegate to the House.
The first research article is Motor Proficiency, Strength, Endurance, and Physical Activity Among Middle School Children Who Are Healthy, Overweight, and Obese by Annabelle Nunez-Gonard, James Moore, Catherine Roach, Tracy Miller, and Neva Kirk Sanchez, all of the University of Miami in Miami, Florida. The purpose of this study was to compare motor proficiency, strength, endurance, and physical activity among children from minority backgrounds who were healthy weight, overweight, or obese. 86 children aged 10 to 15 years of mostly Hispanic ethnicity participated. Children were categorized according to body mass index for age percentile. The following tests were administered. Brunin-Sadzoreski test of motor proficiency, BOT-2, short form, sit to stand, timed up and down stairs, and 6-minute walk test. Physical activity was measured by using activity monitors. 45% of the children were classified as overweight or obese. Compared with children of healthy weight, children who were obese had a lower mean BOT-2, sit to stand, and 6-minute walk test performance. Compared with children of healthy weight, children who were overweight or obese had lower daily mean steps and higher sedentary minutes. In children who were overweight or obese, body mass index was negatively correlated with BOT-2, sit to stand, and abdominal curls. The authors conclude that children who are obese demonstrate greater impairments in motor proficiency, strength, and endurance, and participate in less physical activity than peers of healthy weight.
This article is the subject of the first clinical bottom line in this issue. This written by Brian Rotniak of Duville College in Buffalo, New York, and Anthony Oakley of the University of Wollongong in New South Wales, Australia. Joining me now is Brian Rotniak. Good morning, Brian.
Thanks, Donovan. I'm glad to be here.
Very nice to have you. So this article is not really one with a lot of surprising results. There's a large body of existing evidence about the low physical activity levels found in children who are overweight or obese, but this does add to that body of evidence. Could you tell us about the background of this article and the findings in this article itself?
Sure. So overall, like you said, this research does contribute to this growing body of evidence showing that children with obesity tend to have poorer fundamental movement skills than peers who are leaner. The authors also indicate from the results of the study that children with overweight or obesity might also have poor aerobic fitness and decreased trunk and lower extremity strength. They also provide some additional data to show that kids who are heavier have lower overall steps for physical activity and also spend more time in sedentary behaviors. I think it's also important to point out that I guess one of the more unique things about this study is that over 90% of the children were children with Hispanic ethnicity. So it's good to kind of look at this more, I guess, unique population to see that these results also apply with them. I think this is also a very important issue. We know that about a third of kids in the U.S. are meeting criteria now for overweight or obesity, and providing more evidence on potential strategies that physical therapists can take to help in this epidemic is really important.
Now, that's an interesting point you bring up about how this study had a patient population of mostly Hispanic ethnicity.
I think those are really important. Understanding that children who are Hispanic may have different cultural preferences, they may have different perceptions for one around what healthy weight is, and also additionally around what physical activities that they enjoy. There also may be disparities that could set up people who are of Hispanic ethnicity to make them more likely to be heavier and to engage in less physical activity or to obtain opportunities to develop motor skills. So there's a lot of things beyond just the individual level from a culture perspective that could also play into differences that we see in different ethnicities as well as different races.
With this article in particular, it's a cross-sectional study, and so you point out that there's not a cause and effect that can be established here like you would be able to do in a longitudinal study. What are some of the other things that a critical reader should keep in mind about this particular article?
One of the things is, like you mentioned, it's certainly cross-sectional, so it's hard to determine which way the relationship goes between motor proficiency and weight. And another point, too, is that it's unclear whether this relationship that we see here between motor skill and weight status is a linear one, or if, in fact, there's a particular body weight at which motor skill development is most affected. So, for example, the authors in the study, they used the Brunig-Sassaretsky test of motor proficiency to assess motor skills in these kids. They found that these scores in motor skills were lower for kids with obesity than for children with a healthy weight, but not for children that were overweight. So this, again, might suggest that there's some threshold at which motor deficits are observed, where really you have to be kind of at that really heavier end of the spectrum before you see that this relationship is most affected. Also, the authors really found no statistically significant differences between children with a healthy weight and those that were overweight for motor proficiency, abdominal muscle strength, and endurance, which was assessed with the 6-minute walk test. So it was really just between the extreme, the kids that are at the healthy weight and those that are obese. And I think as these differences become more pronounced when we compare these two groups, it might suggest the important preventative role that motor skills and muscle strength and muscle endurance play in slowing this transition from overweight to obesity, and thus the important role that PTs can play in looking at these outcomes. Another point might be that this Brunig-Sassaretsky test is a product-oriented assessment tool, which means that it kind of assesses oftentimes a success or not successful accomplishment of the task. And it doesn't really grade how the task is done in more of a process way. So a different type of a test that looks at how you do particular skills, the specific observable components that, you know, are developmentally appropriate and present or not present. A test, for example, like the test of gross motor development that does that might be more appropriate, particularly from a physical therapist standpoint, because it could identify the specific developmental components of a motor skill task that would be important to target.
Well, Brian, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Oh, you're welcome, Donovan. Thank you.
Next, reliability and validity of the TIMPSI for spinal muscular atrophy type 1 by Kristen Crosshell of Northwestern University in Chicago, Illinois, and 13 others on behalf of the Project Cure SMA Investigators Network. This study examined the reliability and validity of the Test of Infant Motor Performance Screening Items, TIMPSI, in infants with type 1 spinal muscular atrophy, SMA. After training, 12 evaluators scored 4 videos of infants with type 1 SMA to assess inter-rater reliability. Intra-rater and test-retest reliability were further assessed for 9 evaluators during a SMA type 1 clinical trial, with 9 evaluators testing a total of 38 infants twice. Relatedness of the TIMPSI score to ability to reach and ventilatory support was also examined. Excellent inter-rater video score reliability was noted, with an intraclass correlation coefficient ranging from 0.97 to 0.98. Intra-rater reliability was also excellent, with an intraclass correlation coefficient ranging from 0.91 to 0.98. Test-retest reliability ranged from R values of 0.82 to 0.95. The TIMPSI score was significantly related to the ability to reach. The authors conclude that the TIMPSI can reliably be used to assess motor function in infants with type 1 SMA. In addition, the TIMPSI scores are related to the ability to reach, an important functional skill in children with type 1 SMA. This article is the subject of a clinical bottom line by Elise Townsend and Patricia Chastain, available in print and online. Next, evaluation of static and dynamic postural balance in children with juvenile idiopathic arthritis by Kristen Houghton and Jaime Guzman, both of the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. The purpose of this study was to evaluate balance in children with juvenile idiopathic arthritis and lower limb involvement. 61 children between the ages of 8 and 18 years participated. 25 children had juvenile idiopathic arthritis and lower extremity arthritis within the previous year. 36 children were healthy. All children were assessed by using the Biodex balance system. Single leg static balance at BBS level 12 and bilateral static and dynamic balance, BBS levels 2 and 7, were measured. Lower extremity strength, disease activity, function, and pain were also assessed. 10 of the 25 subjects with juvenile idiopathic arthritis could not complete single leg balance testing, while all controls did. Bilateral dynamic balance was impaired only at BBS level 2, most unstable. Lower extremity weakness correlated with poor balance. The authors conclude that a significant proportion of children with leg arthritis have impaired balance. Proprioceptive exercises may emerge as an important therapy in the treatment of lower extremity arthritis. This article is the subject of a clinical bottom line by Patrick Vondatore and Jan-Jaap Vondernet, available in print and online. Next, development of items that assess physical function in children who use wheelchairs by Cheryl Kerfeld of the University of Washington in Seattle, Washington, Brian Dudgeon, Joyce Engel, and Deborah Carton. The purpose of this study was to assess the content, format, and comprehension of the Patient-Reported Outcomes Measurement Information System, PROMIS, Pediatric Physical Function related to mobility items for children who use wheelchairs. During a cognitive interview, 14 children aged 8 to 12 years who use wheelchairs verbalized their thoughts when answering promise items. The questionnaire appraisal system was used to code summarized text from the interviews. The children requested items be more specific and include options for reporting adaptive ways of performing and participating. How they would answer the item depended on the situation and specific environmental supports and constraints they may have experienced. The authors conclude that as rehabilitation professionals develop and use self-reported outcome measures, they should explore what is important to children who use wheelchairs regarding their views on physical functioning, the influences of the environment, and variability in the use of devices to assist with functional mobility. This article is the subject of a clinical bottom line by Anna Mieres and Jennifer Lamb, available in print and online. Next, GMFM in Infancy, Age-Specific Limitations and Adaptations, by Tijtske Helkema of the University of Groningen in Groningen, the Netherlands, and seven others. The purpose of this study was to evaluate longitudinal applicability of the gross motor function measure, GMFM, in infants younger than 2 years. 12 infants at very high risk for cerebral palsy were enrolled between 1 and 9 months corrected age. The children were assessed 4 times during 1 year with the GMFM 66, GMFM 88, and other neuromotor tests. Longitudinal use of the GMFM in infancy was hampered by age and function-specific limitations. The GMFM 66 differentiated less at lower ability levels than at higher ability levels. The GMFM 88 demonstrated flattening of the developmental curve when infants had developed more motor abilities. The authors formulated adaptations for the longitudinal use of GMFM in infancy. The authors conclude that to facilitate use of the GMFM in infancy, an adapted version may be an option. Further research is required to assess reliability and validity, and in particular, the sensitivity to change of the suggested adaptations. This article is the subject of a clinical bottom line by Amber Richards and Linda Fetters, available in print and online. Next, cardiorespiratory response during physical therapist intervention for infants and young children with chronic respiratory insufficiency, by Helene Dumas of Franciscan Hospital for Children in Boston, Massachusetts, and seven others. The purpose of this study was to document physical therapist intervention activities and cardiorespiratory response for young children with chronic respiratory insufficiency. 12 children born prematurely were included. Their chronological ages ranged from 6 to 30 months. All children had been admitted to inpatient pulmonary rehabilitation for oxygen and/or ventilation weaning. During 3 intervention sessions, a second physical therapist recorded intervention activity and heart rate, oxygen saturation, and respiratory rate. Total time and median heart rate, oxygen saturation, and respiratory rate for each activity were calculated. An analysis of variance was used to compare heart rate and oxygen saturation across activity based on intersession reliability. Sitting activities were most frequent and prone least frequent. Median cardiorespiratory measures were within reference standards for age. No adverse effects were seen during intervention, and no significant difference was found in heart rate and oxygen saturation among intervention activities. The authors conclude that young children with chronic respiratory insufficiency are able to tolerate intervention with close monitoring by the physical therapist. This article is the subject of a clinical bottom line by Maike Sprong and Jan-Jaap van der Net, available in print and online. Next, treadmill training following orthopedic surgery in lower limbs of children with cerebral palsy, by Luanda Greco of Associação de Assistência à Criança Deficiente in São Paulo, Brazil, Tatiana De Freitas, Julia Sate, Eduardo Baña, Claudia Oliveira, and Daniel D'Souza. The purpose of this study was to determine the effect of treadmill training on gross motor function and functional mobility in children with cerebral palsy receiving physical therapy following orthopedic surgery for the lower limbs. Children with cerebral palsy between 8 and 15 years of age participated and were divided into two groups, those having undergone soft tissue surgery and those having undergone both soft tissue and bone surgery. The program consisted of 12 weeks of treadmill training without partial weight support at a frequency of one 30-minute session per week. After treadmill training, significant improvements were found on the gross motor function measure 88, distance traveled on the 6-minute walk test, and time tolerated on the treadmill. The authors conclude that treadmill training during physical therapy is beneficial for children with cerebral palsy who undergo orthopedic surgery in the lower limbs.
This article is the topic of our next clinical bottom line. This clinical bottom line was written by Brad Corr and Regina Harborn, both of the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha, Nebraska. Joining me now are both Brad and Reggie. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Nice to be able to talk to you.
First of all, Reggie, could you give us a little background about how treadmills are used as a modality in this population of children with CP post-surgery?
Well, treadmill training actually was taken a little bit secondarily from the adult population with neurologic problems, spinal cord injuries, and taken into the pediatric realm. So for the past, 10 years maybe, there have been increasing numbers of studies looking at children with cerebral palsy on the treadmill. And there is no absolute right way to do it. There's several different protocols that have been studied, different age groups of children, different severities of cerebral palsy. And so the different thing about this study was that it did address directly the post-surgical patient.
And Brad, for this article in particular, what's your advice for how pediatric physical therapists should use the information to add to that existing body of knowledge? What's the new information in this article?
I think the new information is that with that post-operative patient, the treadmill is a feasible tool to use without an adverse effect, at least in this population, without increasing pain or without increasing complication.
Now, one of the things that I hope jumps out to every reader of this article is the lack of a control group. And so, Reggie, could you talk a little bit about that and how that's a caution in interpreting this article?
Right. Well, they had two groups of children, but both groups were intervention groups. So one group had a bony surgery and one group just had soft tissue surgery. But both of the groups were participating in physical therapy prior to initiating treadmill training, and they continued that therapy during the treadmill training, as well as having had a surgical procedure. So there was no group that either had just the surgical procedure and therapy, but no treadmill training. That would have been a good comparison group, because perhaps just the surgery and the traditional therapy that everyone was getting twice a week that did not include treadmill, perhaps they would have gotten just as far as the children who had this additional treadmill training. But we can't say that. We don't know that. We don't really know whether the treadmill training itself was the thing that caused their progression of skill.
And Brad, you wanted to add something here.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting that with the two groups, that despite the increased immobilization time of the group that underwent the bony surgery in addition to the soft tissue surgery, the outcomes were very similar between the groups.
What does that tell you about the use of the treadmill? Is there a theoretical rationale to think that the treadmill was the difference there? Or is it just that the longer immobilization doesn't really matter in general for children with cerebral palsy?
Yeah, I think the interesting draw out that I took out of it, at least, was that the increased immobilization wasn't a contributing factor to poorer outcomes in these children. So I don't know that it speaks directly to anything about the implementation of the treadmill, but specifically the increased immobilization time wasn't a complicating factor for those children, or at least it would appear that way.
It does seem for some children who are post-surgical that there's a lot of apprehension on the part of the child just to start to move on their own again. And the treadmill environment is very protective. It seems like a safe place for them to move. Just like the pool would be, like you can't really fall down. There's nothing unexpected that's going to happen. It's always the same. So it seems to be an environment in which the child can feel more free to move, you know, to use a walking pattern.
This is part of the advice you guys both offer, good general advice that, remember, clinicians must employ sound clinical rationale, and that's a good clinical rationale for this. You also advise clinicians to use sound evidence-based principles, and I was wondering if you could each share, and we could start with Reggie and then Brad, what would be the evidence-based principles you would employ?
Well, actually, one of my evidence-based principles might not necessarily support the use of a treadmill, because I think one of the things we know from a lot of evidence is that context is important. So learning to walk in the context of your natural environment will allow the best carryover of the skill. So I would have to take into account, if I decided to use the treadmill, that walking in a natural environment was, at this point, not going to be comfortable for the patient. So I wanted to get started anyway, maybe in more of a protective environment. And one other thing we know about evidence is that to learn to walk just during normal development, you need a lot of practice. You need massive practice, which is something that's easy to get on the treadmill. Although you also should be concerned about what that practice is like, what type of practice. So you sort of have to balance those two things, the context and the amount of practice.
And Brad, how about you?
Well, kind of to piggyback on Reggie's idea, one thing that I would say is that as a therapist, providing an intervention to a child, you're always looking for a specific challenge point that is appropriate for that child. So you want to create an environment where they are working and practicing a skill, but at a level that they can continue to process what it is that they are working on or working towards. So where Reggie was saying that this is a consistent environment and a safe environment, I think that is one thing that might bring me to the treadmill as a tool for therapy, is that you can put a child on it and help them to feel safe and help them to feel like they can explore some new movement that just over ground or outside of the handrails of the treadmill, or whether you implement body weight support in addition to it, something along those lines. You can create an environment that allows them the freedom to initiate that movement on their own and feel safe in exploring new types of movement.
Well, Reggie and Brad, thank you both very much for your time today.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
There are three case reports this month. The first is Intervention in the First Weeks of Life for Infants Born Late Preterm, a case series by Stacy Dusing of Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia, Michelle Lobo, Huimin Li, and James Cole Galloway. Infants born late preterm, that is, 34 to 30 weeks of gestation, account for 350,000 U.S. births per year. These infants are at risk for developmental delays and are rarely included in intervention studies. The purpose of this study was to describe a novel parent-delivered movement intervention program for very young infants, and to describe the outcomes following intervention, and to evaluate the feasibility of using a comprehensive set of outcome measures. Two infants born late preterm received intervention from 0.5 to 2.0 months of adjusted age. Development, postural control, reaching, and object exploration assessments were completed at three time points. The intervention was well tolerated by the family. Improvements in developmental outcomes, postural control, and object exploration are presented in this case study. The authors conclude that very early movement experience provided daily by parents may improve development. In combination, norm-referenced and behavioral measures appear sensitive to changes in infant behaviors. Next, application of the NICU practice guidelines to treat an infant in a Level 3 NICU by Beth McManus of both the Colorado School of Public Health and Children's Hospital Colorado in Aurora, Colorado, Juliet Chambliss, and Mary Jane Rapport. The purpose of this case report was to determine how current physical therapy practice in the neonatal intensive care unit, NICU, with one infant adhered to the neonatal physical therapy decision-making framework that was developed as part of the NICU practice guidelines for clinical care. Most physical therapy interventions implemented in this NICU were supported by the algorithm, with some steps more readily implemented than others. This case report highlights the utility of the NICU clinical decision-making algorithm for not only assisting with developing an evidence-based physical therapy plan of care for an infant at high risk, but also its usefulness in revealing NICU programmatic and policy strengths and areas for improvement. The authors recommend for clinical practice that the NICU developmental and therapeutic teams should conduct similar endeavors to assess the quality of physical therapy care in their NICUs. Finally this month, Strength Training for a Child with Suspected Developmental Coordination Disorder by Stacy Mintz of Starfish Therapies in San Mateo, California, Kristen Hatton, and Mary Beth Grant Butler. Children with Developmental Coordination Disorder, DCD, demonstrate difficulty with feed-forward motor control and use varied compensatory strategies. The purpose of this case study was to examine gross motor function changes following strength training in a child with motor control difficulties. The subject for this case was a girl aged 6 years, 11 months, with apraxia and hypotonia, and demonstrating motor delays consistent with DCD. 24 strength training sessions were completed using a universal exercise unit. Post-intervention scores significantly improved on the Brunins-Ozeretsky Test of Motor Proficiency, 2nd edition, and the Canadian Occupational Performance Measure scores. Post-intervention scores were raised on the Developmental Coordination Disorder Questionnaire, revised 2007, to a point above the range where DCD is suspected. Non-significant changes in strength were observed. Improved function and significant gains in manual coordination were observed following blocked practice of isolated, simple joint movements during strength training. Improved motor skills may be because of effective use of feed-forward control and improved stabilization. Strength training does not rehearse skills using momentum, explaining non-significant changes in locomotor or locomotion areas. Thanks for listening. This podcast is a production of Science Audio, online at www.scienceaudio.net. If you have comments or questions about this podcast, we'd love to hear from you. Please email us at pedpt, that's P-E-D-P-T, at scienceaudio.net. Remember to get the full text of all pediatric physical therapy articles, in print or online at www.pedpt.com.